Well, it's my special privilege to welcome Angus Gordon here this morning. Angus is a fourth generation Hawke's Bay person?
Fifth,
yeah. And I was just saying to him as I came in that he's one of my local heroes because he's not only a resident of Hawke's Bay of several generations standing, but he's also taken time out to tell his story. And he may be bashful about promoting this, although I suspect he isn't. But I will put that word in for it because it is a special story about the Cape and Clifton Station and the Gordon family. Angus, we're privileged to have you this morning. We're looking forward to hearing you.
Thank you, Jim.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I use different themes every time I start, but I'll just talk about the book a bit, I think, this time to start with, because technically I'm not a historian. I never was a historian. I always considered myself a writer and wanted to be a novelist, actually, or whatever, a short story writer, which I used to do when I was young. But of course, my family used to go on to me the whole time. Because I was a writer or interested in writing, I had to write the family history. And I couldn't think of anything would have liked to have done less than write the family history, anything more boring. When you're younger, you just don't consider that very important. But I had a very aged old uncle called Lindsay Gordon. I don't know if some of you might have heard of Lindsay Gordon, who was a bit of a character who lived to 102 years old, and his sister lived to 98. And they lived at Farnham House in Clive. And he was the repository of all the so-called family history. So I was sent along to him to get it all written down before he died. And this was when he was about his, I suppose, in his 90s, I suppose. It might have been earlier, it might have been his mid-80s. When I went to see him, I suppose I was in 18, 19. So he seemed very old at the time. But the trouble was, when I went to get his from Lindsay, the two of them would be there because Arlene was there as well. And he would tell the stories, but as he remembered them, then she would say, no, it wasn't quite like that, Johnny dear. And so they would then start arguing. And so I was busy writing down as fact, and the next thing I was being told, it wasn't quite right. So it got a bit confusing, and all this was hearsay that had just been handed down through the family. And a lot of it, as you know, when these family histories tends to get embellished quite a lot. So it got more and more confusing. But I wrote it all down, and I enjoyed my sessions with him. And as I went on with him, I did enjoy it because he'd been born, not sure when Lindsay was born, but he was born, I've got it all in the book, I just can't quite remember, in the 1880s, I think, or 1870s he was born, so, no, it wouldn't be that old, would he? He died in 1990, he would have been about the 1880s. He came from that generation, but he'd never been that interested in the history himself, but because he was an old man, he was considered then the last one, he was considered to know all, and not only the Gordon history, but all the local history around Clive, because he did a lot. So I did all that, and then I put it all away, these funny little notebooks I had, and put it all away, and forgot all about it. And went my way and became a farmer and did all the work and married and had children. It was just far too busy to do anything else. But I got to a certain stage when I was able to lease part of my farm out. And it's amazing, when you've been an active farmer, you're just day in and out, it's just a physical job the whole time. So all your energy's taken up. Suddenly I leased my pastoral side of my farm out. And I had the spare time and the energy to suddenly do it. And what had happened was in 1989, we moved into, my parents had been in the Clifton house for 40 years, and we were all born in the house and bred in the house, of course. They moved out down to Tiawonga, to a house in Tiawonga up Gordon Road, which my grandmother built years ago. So we moved into the house at Clifton, and one of the first things, there's a very big walk-in safe in Clifton. I don't know if there's one in this house, is there? They built a wonderful walk-in safe. It's in the office, anyway. It was part of the office. It was brick, and it's all fireproof. Well, I could walk right into the thing. And it's a fireproof door and everything, because I suppose you're always worried about fires with the old wooden houses. And I went looking in there, and I found this great pile of these books, which were letter books. And I don't know if any of you have ever seen letter books, have you? They're amazing. I'm not still quite sure how it works, the letter books, but very, very thin rice paper, and they're actually books, and they've got letter book on the outside. So every letter that was ever written, this is by my grandfather, he kept a record of every letter he wrote, every sent to England, he kept a record in the letter book. So it was obviously like, it's not quite a carbon copy, but it's like that. And luckily for me, my grandfather's writing was terribly easy to read. It was beautiful writing, very easy to read. And I started just fiddling through these things, and they went right back to the 1880s. And I got absolutely completely absorbed, because he just told the whole story of Clifton there and the thing. Because what the story was that he'd come out to manage the farm. The family actually lived in England and Devon. They'd moved back to Devon fairly shortly. They weren't farmers, they were actually businessmen from India. My great-great-grandfather, James Gordon, who was the first to come to Hawke's Bay in 1859, he was actually a retired businessman. So he was 66 years old when he actually came to New Zealand for the first time. New Zealand was actually a place for young people to come and pioneer, not old people. But what had happened was that the banks that had the Indian Mutiny in India, they were living in India, and he was a jute merchant in India. Both his sons were in the Indian Army. They were in the cavalry, and they fought in the Sikh Wars, and they fought in the mutiny. Now, what happened was, after the mutiny, a bit like what's happening now, things don't change much, all the banks crashed, the Calcutta banks crashed. Everyone had all their huge investment in India, and that investment tipped over, all the banks crashed. And so, in this particular case, J.G. Gordon actually retired back to Scotland, and he was actually retired living in Scotland. His sons were in the army, still in India and married. But he must have lost an awful lot of money. But he can't have lost it all, because at that stage, New Zealand and Australia were just opening up. And if you look at the first lot of settlers that first came to Hawke's Bay, an awful lot of them were ex-Indian Army officers and soldiers and things like that, because they went through the mutiny, and obviously it was a disturbing time. Things were, you know, it wasn't very pleasant. Then they had the crash afterwards, and a lot of soldiers got out of India after that. A lot of people left India. Women particularly weren't very comfortable living in India any longer after what they'd been through. And of course, New Zealand was opening up. So James had his own schooner that he'd actually had from, this is the most amazing, at his age, he had his own schooner that they'd had for trading between India and Scotland, because all the jute in those days was in Benares, which is now called Varanasi, on the Ganges River, which is the most religious place in India now, of course. And he had his schooner that they used to use to take a lot of the jute back to Dundee, because Dundee was the prime place for jute in those days. A big industry it was in those days, when they made all the ropes and the sacking and the bags and the wool packs. Everything was made out of jute. His wife had died, and he set off from Scotland and came all the way to New Zealand with his crew, obviously, because he obviously heard about the possibilities, obviously thought, well, it would be a great place for his sons to come and settle down with his family. So he came here, and that's how he ended up with the Cape area, I think, because he sailed. He wouldn't have known anything about farming at all, no idea about farming, but this coast, as you know, the whole coast from, well, Pohuri was the first area, of course, to be settled in Hawke's Bay, but the whole coast up to the Cape in this area was quite dry area, so it was all natural grassland and fern. It was actually looked pretty good for farming, because there was no real bush, because it's too dry, the hills are too dry. And then, of course, sailing along that coastline from Waimarama up to the Cape and then across to Clifton, it's just stunning. I mean, you know, it's the most stunning. So he would have thought, well, this looks quite a nice sort of place. And so he was lucky enough, he was the first in, because, as you know, before 1855, you weren't allowed to buy land off the Maori at this stage. It had to be leased off the Maori. And then the Maoris themselves went to Governor Grey. You see, in Hawke's Bay, all we basically had down here in the early 40s was whalers, mainly whalers and a few sort of rather disreputable characters. And a lot of the Maoris come back, they drifted back from New Hawke and all that area to come back to Hawke's Bay in the 40s and the 50s, because, as you know, they were all moved up to New Hawke, most of the Maoris in this area. They came back, but they weren't very happy with the type of white man that was sort of around the area here, because they were pretty wild, drunken lot, and the other would have been at Ahuriri. So they actually went to Governor Grey originally and suggested that they sell the land to the government. And that's when Donald Maclean became involved. And before that happened, settlers were allowed to come to Hawke's Bay, like the Nairns came to Hawke's Bay, and the Pohuri and the Tiffins and these sort of people. They were allowed to lease big acreages of land, and you were allowed to just own 80 acres of land around your homestead. You were allowed to own that land, but the rest was leased. You weren't allowed to buy land. And it was very confusing. There was a lot of confusion about boundaries and about who owned what, and sheep or oil. It was a very confusing. So the government tidied it up. Donald Maclean came up, did a fantastic job, bought great tracts of land off the Maori after negotiation. And of course, the famous one, you know, is Te Hapuka. The Hapuka block was the big block, half a million acre block, which really goes, well, all the way, Pakarau, Pohuri, all that sort of whole coastal area back inland. He sold that. So our area we're talking about, the Kidnappers block, was actually a small block. It was 30,000 acres, which was bought off, well, the main chief in those days was Te Moananui Hawea, and his relation's still here today. He's one in a wheelchair. He's the direct line of that line. But he sold the Kidnappers block to Donald Maclean. So by the time James Gordon came to Hawke's Bay in 59, it was a perfect time. Everyone was arriving in Hawke's Bay. The land had been bought, so you bought the land off the government. You didn't buy it off the Maori. So they had the parcels of land, and then you bought the part. Because the interesting story about the Kidnappers block is that originally, when it was in the leasing days, when the first people here were the Rhodes brothers, one of the first people that actually set up Clive, They thought Clyde was going to be the original capital. It's all planned, it was all subdivided up. They applied for 1 million acres of land for the whole of what they call the Kidnappers Block, and it went from here, it must have gone all the way from here, virtually to Cape Turnagain, somewhere down there. They just applied for the whole block of land. And you won't guess what they wanted to pay for it. £150. And even in those days, that wasn't very much money. And needless to say, it was turned down and they lost it. So they were actually leasing the land at Clifton, for example. They were leasing that whole block. They'd been leasing just grazing sheep. They didn't have any buildings there. There was no yards. There was nothing there. So they lost that lease, and J.G. Gordon bought the property. He bought 13,500 acres of what was called the Kidnappers Block, which went from Clifton, where we are. The Maraetotra River was the boundary, and all the way to the back road where the road goes down to Ocean Beach, that was the back boundary as well, because that was always a track. In the old days, the track that the Maori used and that the first settlers used went down the back of where Tararapa is and Haupiri, down to Ocean Beach. They went down to the beach and along the beach to Waimarama. That was our back boundary, and then we came forward from there. And so he bought the property, and he paid £3,375 in those days, which was actually quite a lot of money. The government bought the block, I think, for about £2,000. That Kidnappers Block, the whole 30,000 acres, and then they sold our block for £3,300. The other blocks within the Kidnappers Block were Clifton and the Grange and Tukituki. So the Tukituki River was the boundary of the Kidnappers Block. So there were actually only three properties on that. The Tukituki side of the river was Clifton, the Grange and Tukituki. So he bought the property for that money, and then he sailed back to India. By then his first son was married and had a child, and so they wanted to get out of the army. They were in their mid-30s, they obviously wanted to leave the army. So the father went and said, look, we're going to move to New Zealand. How do you feel about it? They obviously agreed. They had a house. Before they came back to New Zealand, they actually had the house, the first house, prefabricated out of teak in India. They actually had it made. And I don't know if people have seen the picture of the original house, but it was a very, very pretty house. Michael Fowler used to make a big issue of it, the architect, because of the fact that when they first came here, it was the first house that actually had a veranda right round it. Of course, it had a veranda because it was Indian. That's what they had in India. So they came back, but my great-grandfather didn't come back because he was still settling his affairs in India, but my great-great-grandfather and one of his sons came to New Zealand and arrived at Clifton, and they anchored offshore, and the whole house, because it was all big, you know, parts, and they threw it all overboard, and he brought Indian Army mules with him, and they dragged everything ashore. James was in charge of jumping over in the water with a pitchfork to try and fend off any sharks that they thought might attack Indian Army mules. That's what they worried about. So the house was dragged ashore there at Clifton, exactly where the present homestead is, and was built. And the only real luxury that my great-great-grandfather insisted on was he bought a bath with him. And the bath was the only casualty. Of the whole thing, the bath was the only casualty. It got kicked by a mule. But it didn't break it. It apparently had a great big dent in it. So that was the only casualty. So they set up there at Clifton. So this is the history. So Lindsay started telling me all these sort of stories, and it sort of sounded a bit too good to be true. And we all thought for a start that he was inventing a lot of this stuff, because it was quite, you know, it's quite dashing sort of stuff, really, to be doing all this in those days, especially at your age, 67. But it turned out to be all true, and so that got me interested as time went on. So the family came to New Zealand, they settled here, my great-grandfather came up with his wife. They were living at Clifton. In those days, if you can imagine, there were no trees, nothing. Where Clifton was all by itself, they had to cross five rivers to get to Napier. And they were lucky they had the boat. Obviously, they would use the ship occasionally, but that would have been actually eventually anchored round at Ahuriri, because they used to use the boat to pick up the wool all down the coast and all through to Wairoa. A lot of the wool was picked up when they first started. They had an unfortunate incident when they were living there. My great-grandmother had come from the Indian Mutiny, and they'd come from all that terrible time when so many women were slaughtered, particularly, and raped and all the rest of it. And they were sitting at Clifton one day on a lovely day like this. The whole family was there. She had three children at that stage and another one on the way. My grandfather had just been born in Napier. He was the first Gordon to be born in New Zealand. They could see this great cloud of dust galloping towards them across the plains, the flats. And it was this group of Hauhau Māori, because what had happened was the Hauhau had just arrived in Napier, and they were upsetting the equilibrium of the whole area. And they galloped up, 20 of them, and they were full moko, the whole works. And they must have been terrifying. And if you'd been in India and you'd gone through all the Indian Mutiny time, and suddenly here you were out here all by yourselves at a little property, these guys galloping round and round, and they galloped round and round the house, you know, yahooing and blood curdling yells. And then they jumped off and they all came in and they just pushed the family aside and walked into the house and just walked all around and picked everything up. And it must have been terrifying at the time. JG and Thomas, my great-grandfather, eventually got them out. But as they were leaving, one of them said, "We will be back." And it was a big threat. And of course, Janet Gordon was heavily pregnant at the time and it was all very stressful. So they left and they raced off. And my great-grandfather, Thomas, was actually, they formed militias in Napier at the time because, as you know, it was a very tense time all around that time. They had a militia and he'd been commissioned because he was a cavalry officer to form a little group of soldiers. And they used to practice every week. He'd ride into Napier and they would practice drilling, but they didn't have guns, they didn't have anything, they just had wooden guns, but they were just practicing. So he took off as soon as this had happened. He raced, he knew something was on. He galloped all the way to Napier to find out what was happening. This is when they found out that the Howe House had moved into Maranui and were causing a lot of trouble, and Donald McLean had decided that he was going to put an end to it. So they got all the local Maori in Napier and all the rest, and they formed up the troops. And so Thomas then had to gallop all the way back to Clifton, get his uniform, get his sword and all the rest of it, tell his wife what he was doing, going off to war again. She couldn't believe it, that she thought they'd come all the way to New Zealand to get away from all that. And here he was off to war again. He then went to Napier. The troops all set off. I think they set off overnight. They wanted to get there in the early morning. In those days, as you remember, the inner harbour of Napier was all water. So Patani and all that area were on the coast. So to get down that way, you had to go right inland to Maranui, and then you went over the hills all the way along the coast. His job was to go to Patani and check, because they thought some of the Hauhau were coming in there on canoes, and they were to meet them. And the other one was Captain Fraser. I did not go on about him too much, but he was at Bay View. Captain Fraser was the one that actually eventually confronted a lot of the coming in there. But the main lot of them were at Maranui. My grandfather got there. They rode all night in the dark to get to this place, waited, nothing happened. In the morning, they could hear the guns shooting back at Maranui, and so eventually nothing was happening at the beach, so they all galloped back and there was this little battle. It was a very small battle. It's the only battle we had in Hawke's Bay. It was the only at Maranui, and by the time he got back they'd been routed and they'd taken off. So they ran after them and then they were called back by Donald McLean. And one of the only casualties of the whole thing was a man who was lying on the ground. When Thomas, my great-grandfather, got back after they'd been chasing him, they got back and there was this guy and he recognised him. It was the gardener from Clifton. And the poor guy had had his jaw shot. He wasn't too bad, but he'd had his jaw shot. He was one of the only casualties, I think. And the poor guy said, "Well, I came to New Zealand to get away. I came to be a gardener, not to be a soldier." So he wasn't particularly impressed with his job. But he went back to Clifton, went on gardening, and Thomas looked after him for the rest of his life. It was quite interesting. I never knew what his name was, that man, the gardener, until 2 years ago. Someone read my book, and one of the members of his family came to see me, and it was his great-grandchildren came to see me. I just can't remember the name of the man, but they gave me his name and they knew all about him because it was his first job in New Zealand. So that was rather nice. You know, that's what's been nice about the book. Since I've written the book, it's been really nice because people come to me all the time. It's answered questions for them, or they know things that I didn't quite have the full story. So that was a nice connection. And that family actually now lives mainly in Australia. So unfortunately, after all that drama and Janet was left at Clifton, she just couldn't handle it with all these children. She just couldn't handle being at Clifton all by herself while he was racing off doing things, so she said she wanted to go back to Scotland. So they left. That family, the Thomas Edward Gordons, they left and went back to Scotland. But the old fella, J.G. Gordon, the original one, my great-great-grandpa, he stayed. He decided he was too old to muck around, and he'd got his bath by then and he was quite comfortable. So he stayed at Clifton, and this is when the Hill family, the Hills of Fern Hill, they were also soldiers. Kendrick Hill was also a soldier. He was a friend of Thomas Edward's. He had been in the army in India as well, another Indian army man. There were an awful lot of them in Napier originally. He came out and managed Clifton for the family. That's how the Hill connection goes on. And I could go on all about that, about Hastings and about the 12 Apostles and all that stuff, but I won't talk about that today because that's another story. But the Hill family were very closely involved with our family, and he managed Clifton for about 15 years or so until my grandfather was old enough and he came back to New Zealand to take over the farm as a cadet, first of all, under Kendrick Hill, and then he ran it. And in the meantime, the Gordons had bought Fern Hill, and they went into partnership with Fern Hill, and that's how the Hills eventually ended up at that area, because they bought the Gordons out of Fern Hill. But that's a long story. So all this history, Lindsay didn't really know all this, but it was in, from there on, these books that my grandfather, these letter books, for 50 years there was this detailed description, because the family were living back in England, and my grandfather was here managing the farm for the family. He had to send back detailed reports to the family, so he wrote these letter books, and they're the most You know, they're very thick, and it's very fine, fine paper. He wrote this detailed, so I started reading these things, and I suddenly realised then that maybe one day, if I had time and the energy, I would write the history, because suddenly I had a lot of valuable material. Because up to then I'd said to the family, well, they were quite a quiet family, the original Gordons. They didn't mix around a lot. They weren't the great horse racing lot that a lot here were. They were stuck out there and all these rivers to get across. They lived quite a quiet life. And I said, there's not much of a story there. There's just not enough to tell. As they came, they did this and they went something. But once I got these letter books, I suddenly realised there was a good story to tell, because it was all the details. It was wonderful. All the main details of, you know, the original house was burnt down. Frank was my grandfather. This is the one that was managing for the family, Frank Gordon. They went to England. They always came back and forth to England, as you know, in those days. A lady here, she went over latterly on a Rangitata. My father was a boy when they were going back and forth to England. But on one of the trips, the family were coming back to New Zealand, and the original house was being aired. The housekeeper was airing it all out, because they had those tilly lamps, and a lamp tipped over, caught fire, and burnt the house down. The whole house was burnt down, but everything was saved, because they were sharing at the time, and there were 40 people down at the sharing shed, down at the wool shed, and with all the shepherds and the sharers. They came up and they got all the original furniture. Have you been into Clifton? Yes, we've got a lot of very ornate Indian furniture. It's all very ornate. It's all hand-carved furniture. And that furniture was what JG brought out with them in the first boat. They managed to get everything out of it, so that everything was saved, the grandfather clocks and all that stuff, but the house itself burnt to the ground. So my grandfather then decided to build Clifton, and obviously that's the time when this house here was built earlier, this was 1880s, but a lot of the big ones like Clifton and Guavis and these type of places were all built around about the 1890s, 1900s. It was a very prosperous time for wool again, you know, because everything else went up and down. Very prosperous times. And Frank's first wife was actually Ellen Tanner. Thomas Tanner, you know all about Thomas Tanner, one of the original settlers of Havelock here. Thomas Tanner was her father. And they had a house in Napier called Balquhidder, which is still there today. They didn't have a house to live in at Clifton, so they moved into Balquhidder in Napier. And they designed what's not Nartouche. It was a chap called Finch was the actual architect, but he worked for Nartouche. It's the same people that designed the Hawke's Bay Club to design the house. While they lived there. Well, of course, because they were living in Balquhidder, they were influenced by the design of Balquhidder. So a lot of the original ideas from Clifton came from Balquhidder. It's sort of quite similar in many ways. Although Balquhidder's since been fiddled around with and modernised in place and had lots of different owners, it's lost a lot of its character over the years. Well, it's hard to believe it, but I found this out in the letter books. The house only took 6 months to build. Clifton only took 6 months to build. And I was down at Gravis yesterday because they're redoing Gravis. The young girl's moving back into Gravis and they're doing Gravis up. It's not actually that bad. It's not run down at all. It's been very well maintained. And they said that they think Gravis was built quite quickly as well. The top story was added in about 3 months. The reason being, I think, is because they got all the timber organised a year before and it was all dry. And all the windows, little sashes, everything would have been pre-made. All the alcoves and all that sort of thing would have all been done. And then they would have moved out and they did camp on the job. They could have had 20 or 30 builders because it took 6 months to put that house up. Because in the letterbox, just wrote the letter saying, we'll start on the house today, and then 6 months later, we've just moved into the house. So these letterbooks were fantastic because they were the actual facts. They weren't my Uncle Lindsay's romantic ideas or anything else. They were actually the facts. And it went right down basically to about the 1930s. The only time I had trouble reading it was when he went home to England at one stage and his brother, who was a partner with him in Clifton at the stage, came and looked after the place for a year, and he had writing that went like that. It was just impossible to read. He could read it, but it was flat, and it was extraordinary. My grandfather had such easy writing. I managed to decipher a lot of it, because he was actually quite interesting. While he was looking after the place, a lot of dramas happened. There was a lot of good stuff came out of those ones, so it was worth persevering. And I still didn't read, so, but I left the farm out, and then suddenly I had this time to write the book, and I thought, right, I'll just go for it. So I just got down and spent about a year, and I wrote it there and then, and we've got a very good manager in our cafe at Clifton, and the cropping side was easy to run, so I was able to have enough time to write the book, and I did it in one sitting, really, and I got some wonderful photographs. And I tried to tell it in a chronological order, more as a story, so that you can actually read it from beginning to end and enjoy it. There's a story with the chronological. A lot of the books get a bit confusing. A lot of the books that have been done, they try to put too much information into some of these books, and there's a lot of stories, and some of the books have been written about Hawke's Bay, but they're fragmented. You can't can't really sit and read it from beginning to end because they're a bit fragmented. They're more research books and more, you know, just record books. But I wanted to make mine more of a readable type of novel type idea. And I published it myself because it's very hard to get anyone interested. And I've sold now nearly 1,000 copies of the book, of this hardback copy. I just sell it at the cafe and at the woolshed because we've turned our woolshed into a museum and a farm show, and we do shows and things for the tourists and schools and things like that there. I only sell the book there, but it seems it just goes on selling, which has been very gratifying for me. It just goes on selling, and people are interested, and they come up, and Jim's very kindly sent nice things today to me, and it's been very heartening to do that. But technically I'm not a historian, but I became a bit of a historian. And now my latest project is I'm trying to do, because I'm so fascinated with the whole of Hawke's Bay, I mean, that was my first start. You'd obviously do your family when you start, because that's what you know, and you've got all the information. But there's been a lot written about Hawke's Bay, but one of the things that interests me is the old buildings in Hawke's Bay, the old wool sheds, because all the original wool sheds that were built in Hawke's Bay, the older they are, the better they are, the better condition they are. There's some fantastic sheds all around Hawke's Bay, big sheds and little sheds, but they are beautifully built, and every one of them is a different design. It's almost as if they're architecturally designed. So what I'm doing is I'm trying to do a record of all of Hawke's Bay, going up every single road when I get time. You know, if I get a couple of spare days in the week, I take off in this nice weather now, and then you just go up. And I know a lot of the people, I know of a lot of people up the street, and they're only too happy. And I'm taking photographs of the buildings, but I'll have to put it together in a book myself, and doing little stories with each one. Because it's a fantastic record we've got at Hawke's Bay. But Hawke's Bay is such a beautiful place. And a lot of these wool sheds actually add to the beauty of the place. I mean, as well as the homesteads and the buildings, but the wool sheds too, because they fitted in. Where they built the wool sheds was in a lot of very special places. And I mean, you go down the coast, for example, you go down to Akateo or Tautani or Burnview. Or wherever you go, they're fantastic sites, and they're all different buildings. That's what I'm doing about this part. So I won't go on, but if anyone's got any questions, I'm only too happy to answer.
You're going to be doing an appendix with all these extra bits and pieces you've found out since you published?
That's quite a good point. I might have to one day, yes. But the trouble is, publishing your own book, it's an expensive operation. Because I did this myself and I've got coloured photographs at the back, I did it like this with photographs all through. If you wanted to do it cheaper, you do it with the photographs all in a bunch in the middle, you know. But I did it because I'd rather have it as a sequel, to have the photographs relevant to the story as you wrote. That is a very expensive way of doing it. And it's very good quality paper. I wanted to do it really well. But it cost me a lot of money. What I did was I did 1,000 of these hardback, which I've nearly finished, and then I did another 1,000 of softcover, ones which are cheaper, they'll be cheaper. And that was cheaper to print. So I wouldn't want to do any more until I've sold them.
How long ago is it?
September 2004. We had a launch in the cafe. And that's how you sort of sell a few of these books and these sort of things. My greatest regret, though, is that because it was cost so much, and my printers, because I'm the publisher, said to me, oh, you've got to charge at least, he said $70, but I said, no one will buy it for $70. And so he said, well, you can't sell it for any less than $60. So we had 350 people at the book launch, and it was a big affair because I can take a lot of people in the cafe. But we didn't sell as many as I thought we were going to sell it originally. I've started selling the book more as I brought the price down. And it's more of a reasonable price. I'm actually selling it in the bookshops. Well, the poppies sell it for $45, I think, now, something like that. But I sell it, on these sort of occasions, I just sell it for $35 now. And it's more accessible. But, of course, it cost me about nearly $30 to print it. So it's an expensive operation. And I'm worried about this other book, this one on the woolshed, because the woolshed, of course, is going to be all photographs, mainly. It's more a photograph book. And it's all going to be big photographs, because, you know, try and make it quite special. God knows what that's going to cost, so I'm going to have to try and find. I'm just doing it at the moment, I'm not worrying about that side of it. I'm getting all the material together, getting the stories together, doing the photographing, and then I'll worry about that next. But I'm sure I can find someone to sponsor, some, you know, people. The Eastern, what is it, Central Community Trust, they're quite right there. Those sort of people.
And
you'll
have more applications for the whole of the country.
Yeah. I mean, everyone says, why don't you do the woolsheds in New Zealand? But, I mean, it's big enough to do Hawke's Bay. When you realise you've got the amount of time you've got to go down every single road in Hawke's Bay, it's a long way. And you trundle down there. I did the Yata Road the other day, so you go down and you go up every individual drive to meet people. And you have to try and ring the people, but it's always very hard to make meetings. So what I'm doing now is just driving down there, because I know a lot of them, and I go in there and if they're there, I meet them, or otherwise I ring them and tell them, I'm only taking photographs at this stage, and just going through the sheds. But of course they're fascinating because you've got all the graffiti inside the sheds. Mm. They tell a story in their own right. Unfortunately, a lot of people, for some unknown reason over the years, they've got a thing about the graffiti and they washed a lot of it off. Then they won't let them do it nowadays, but that tells a story in its own right. And some of the old, like in the Guava shed and in the Aramona shed, they've still got the old water pump hydraulic presses that they used to use. And there's a huge amount of history in some of the Guava shed. When I was there yesterday, I didn't realise, but the original shed was actually wooden shingles on the roof. Very well built. They built them so well then, you see. I mean, the sheds you've built today, I've got one. I've got a new shed up on the farm. It's at Woolaway, and they are just, they don't last. They're built of tantalised pine. They all put up. They all look exactly the same, and they wear out much quicker than these old sheds that were built in the 1880s and 1890s. They're still going. Well, I went to a fantastic shed yesterday, and I don't know if any of you know Paparangi, back at Kerru. It's a shed that's completely fallen to pieces, a big shed, but it was the most beautiful shed. The shape, the large shed architecture were an absolute delight, and it's still there, so I managed to get a whole lot of photographs of it, but that shed's too far gone to resuscitate.
Look at the
Ruakākau
shed.
Yeah, Ruakākau shed's in fantastic condition, and it's in fantastic condition inside. There's nothing wrong, and a lot of those sheds, even that funny little shed over at the Mission in Napier, and you know, Church Road, there's a little wool shed there. It's a beautiful little wool shed. Well, that's really old. I mean, I don't know, I haven't found out the story of it yet, but you go in there and they've got the ceiling, they've actually got the timbers on the ceiling. So you've got the tin, like a lot of the wool sheds just built, you've just got your rafters and then you've got your tin. But these are actually boarded, so they've got boards all on the tin, so really old. And that's a sweet little shed, you see, those type of sheds, no one even pays any attention, they're all over the place. It's really very much a part of our heritage, I think, in Hawke's Bay.
Angus, will you include in your book the landing shed at Takatea? They stored the wool before the ship.
Is it still there?
No, no. It was there in the 1980s, but it's now pulled down and they've replaced it with the community hall in a different location.
Yeah, it's a little can
marking where it was.
I don't know that one. Well, my family's involved with Tartani Station, and Tartani and all those coastal properties like Burnview and Pippibank, they used to take their wool along the coast to Cape Turning in there. Have you been along to? And that's a wild coast along there. But when you get in under Cape Turning, there's this little bay. This beautiful little bay, and they had a jetty made there, and they had a wool dump. The same thing, because they used to dump all the wool on those coastal properties, two barrels into one, and to take them out. It must be really heavy. They would have weighed about 400 kilos. Pretty heavy, nearly half a ton. Yeah, the one at Tautani, well, the one on that coast at Cape Trinity, it's still, you can see all the concrete in the thing, because they had a jetty in the thing, and they had to go out through this thing, and there was a mouth, a little entranceway out through the rocks, and you just had to choose your moment, and out through the rocks you went, and it was quite calm. This is on the south side of Cape Trinity. There's a seal colony there on the actual Cape Point itself, and then just back in the corner. It's a lovely little sheltered little bay, out of the wind and everything.
Angus, getting back to the family again, I seem to remember there was a big slump in wool prices. It was about 1890, and they were getting absolutely nothing for their wool. How did the family survive?
Well, they did. I mean, they certainly had ups and downs all the time. You know, reading through my grandfather's letterbook, I remember he was very depressed. But they seemed to get through. I don't know. They must have set aside money from the years before, and they had enough invested, and they were able to carry on. Because it then came right, you see. When did the frozen lamb start? Late 1880s. Yeah, you see. So suddenly there was another option by then, because the Nelson brothers started quite early up here.
King talks of the Long Depression, the 16-year depression that went from 1877 to 1893. So things came right in the 1890s and good money was made, but my great-grandfather was bankrupted in that time.
I think Hawke's Bay here, they survived because they were so big, economy of scale in those days still. They were still big properties because the big properties didn't really start getting broken up until the early 1900s. So they still had the economy of scale, I suppose, at that stage. And you were quite self-sufficient on your place. I mean, you had all your own sheep and everything, all your meat and your gardens. So a lot of the farms, those big farms, were quite self-sufficient.
There was another factor there too. In about 1908, the first Land Act was passed, and there were subsequent amendments to that. And basically that started breaking up some of the big properties, the bigger estates.
Land Acquisition Act, it was called. Well, they were given an option that you had to break up, or you know, and that's when most of the properties became smaller properties. 1907, I think it was, and it was a compulsory acquisition, but they bought the land. I think it was £3 an acre. It was quite a little amount of money. My great-grandfather owned a lot of land down at Highway 50, and he fell over a waterfall. He'd acquired a lot of land over a period of time, because he was a soldier as well in the government. Those soldiers got a lot of land then, because I suppose they were working for the government, they got given land, or they got cheap rates, or whatever. But he fell over a waterfall, and he was collecting plants. The whole family were young, the family were the very first to have to give up their lands. And they were offered £3 an acre, and it was just lucky for them that Sidney Johnson, that was at Orua Thorough, was the trustee, and he managed to get up to £5 an acre. But yeah, on the whole, they were buying the land for £3. Right. No more questions? If anyone wants a book, I'm sending a special, it's $35 anyway.
Angus, thank you for that. It's been a wonderful hour. You are, to us, Mr. Hawke's Bay, because your great-great-grandfather was James Gordon, also Thomas Tanner, and your great-grandfather was Colonel Herrick.
That's right, Jasper Herrick, yeah.
So those are all names that are very much ingrained in Hawke's Bay. I think it's wonderful. I invite people who get down and tell their stories, as you have. Thank you for this morning. It's been a great talk to kick our series off with. Welcome to the Viewart House Society and our history talks. This is the one for November, and I think, Angus, you're our most popular speaker because you've come back a second time. And we're looking forward to hearing more about Clifton Station and its history and its current operations, now catering for cruise ships with a lot of other things going on associated with the station. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Angus Gordon.
Good morning, everyone. I just couldn't quite remember what we talked about last time, but I think I did the history last time. So what I thought, this year is actually our 150th year of the family being at Clifton since the first time we actually bought. The property was bought in 1859, but we didn't actually arrive here until 1861, so I'm never quite sure which date. So next year we're going to have our 150th in the middle, we're going to compromise. So at some stage I've got to organise a big party next year for the 150th, and our cafe's been going now for over 10 years, so the staff want a 10-year anniversary party, and it's my 60th, and I'm my wife's 60th, so we might do a one-stop shop and have the whole lot in one hand, so you don't have to worry too much. So I thought this time I'd just talk about the last 60-odd years and bring it right up to date. Yes, since the war, because I think I talked up to about the war last time. I'm not quite sure where I got to, but there's an awful lot happened, and I thought I'd just bring in just a few other aspects. So I sort of started just after the war, when my father came home from the war. My father was an only son. My grandfather, Frank Gordon, who'd run the station for 50-odd years way back, and I talked about him last time, he had a first marriage to Ellen Tanner, and she died, and then he remarried again when he was 60 to my grandmother, who was 40. So when my father was born, it was just a very tenuous link for the Gordon family, because Uncle Lindsay Gordon and his wife didn't have any children, and his sister also didn't have any children. So the line was just about to peter out. And at the last minute, Frank remarried at the age of 60 and had a child, which was my father, to his wife, who was 40 at the time. So he only had one child. And my grandfather died just before the war in 37. My grandmother, who was never very keen on New Zealand because she was an English woman and she didn't really like living out here, she packed up the bags, closed Clifton up, put the sheets over all the furniture. There was a housekeeper left in charge of the house and left and went back to England, never intending to come back again. But my father had been brought up on Clifton for 13 years, and you know, when you're brought up on farms in Hawke's Bay in New Zealand and you've had that lovely life, it gets right into your system, and he was always very affected by New Zealand. And so he went to school at Harrow in England, and then he served in the British Army at the end of the war because he was quite young. And when the war finished, he stayed on, and he was in Italy sort of mopping up and doing all the cleaning up stuff. He decided he wanted to come back and farm in New Zealand. And well, he'd always wanted to. And the farm was just sitting there. And so back they came, the end of 1947. You can imagine the state of the house has been closed up for 10 years, and when you're out at the beach out there, we have to wash the house. Every year we have to wash Clifton because it's white, and because we get the salt air and the pollen from all the trees and everything else, it gets very dirty. So after 10 years, when they came back to Clifton, the outside walls were virtually black. So it's quite a job to get it all tidied up. And also all the elm trees, we have a lot of elm trees at Clifton. We had two huge elm trees in the backyard, monster elm trees. And elm trees, as you know, they sucker, something terrible. They'd luckily kept the suckering out of the garden, but they'd gone into the back, and the whole of the back plantation was just a huge area, about 10 acres of elms that had suckered up. And so we've still got now this huge plantation. We've actually lost, I'll come to the slip later on, but we've actually lost a lot of those elms in the big slip we had in 2006. It came down and there was mud that thick lying around a lot of the trees, and I suppose I've taken out about 20 odd big trees. We just couldn't handle the mud being around, they sort of got suffocated, and so we've had to take about 20 trees out, which has been a nuisance, but they still keep on popping up, of course. They always just pop up everywhere. So anyway, he came back to Hawke's Bay and to start farming at Clifton. Clifton at the stage is now 2,000 acres, and it's remained that size for quite a long time, and it's still that size now. And he eventually met my mother, who was Barbara Herrick. The Herricks owned, well, they lived at Lindisfarne. So where the college is at Lindisfarne, the Lindisfarne house was their house. And they owned a big station down the coast called Tautani, which is still in the Herrick family today, actually. We had our 100th anniversary, 2002, I think it was. So another sort of farming family. So my mother was the youngest of a family of eight, big family, and they'd all lived in Lindisfarne for however many years. And in that time, my grandfather, E.J. Herrick, Eddie Herrick, was quite a well-known character around the area. He was chairman of Williams & Kettle, was chairman of the Harbour Board, and he was governor of the Reserve Bank and things like that. And so he was quite well-known at the time. But they had this big family, and in the war, it was quite a tragedy because they had six boys altogether, and five of the boys went off to the war, and three of them were killed. And the three that were killed were the youngest, and they were all serving in the Air Force. And the two that served in the Navy, one of them is still alive today, and the other one's only just died last year, aged 97. So the attrition of losing three boys was quite strong on my grandmother. But in those days, she was a very strong woman, and they just got on with the job. They kept on wrapping presents and parcels and sending to England and doing all the good work she used to do. So keep her mind off the tragedy, I think, of losing all those boys. It's quite fun today because Lindisfarne are trying to build up a bit of a history. Because it's a modern new school, it hasn't got a lot of history, they tend to use the Herrick connection as their sort of heritage. Because when my grandfather sold it to the school, he wanted it to be a school, and it was called Lindisfarne at the time, so it was quite useful that it was sold to be a Presbyterian school, of course. And he sold it at a reduced rate to help them get started as a school. So the school have always been very grateful to Eddie Herrick and the family, and 2 years ago they commissioned a portrait of the three brothers, which was really rather nice thing to do because my mother only had little photographs of them. And they've done a big portrait now of the three brothers all standing side by side, taken from these photographs, and it's a very good portrait which they've hung in the hallway at Lindisfarne. My grandfather was also one of the original deer stalkers when wapiti and moose were first introduced into New Zealand. E.J. Herrick was not quite the first, but he was the first to shoot a moose, of course, but also the wapiti. And he's got lots of big heads. We've got two huge heads. We've got the moose head in Clifton, plus the biggest wapiti head he ever shot. And then Lindisfarne asked if they could have one of his heads, so, which my mother was very happy to do. So we'd had a head down the woolshed. We turned our woolshed, I'll tell you later on, into a tourist thing, and we had one of the heads down there. So we presented it the other day to the school, and it was quite impressive because we presented the whole school. It was on a table. It was covered over. And they didn't know what it was, the school. And then we sort of sat up in the front of the school, and then they pulled the sheet off, and there was a collective gasp from the whole crowd, which is quite interesting. And at the end, they did a haka. The whole school, I don't know how many kids there are. There's about 500, 600 kids at the school. Did a haka on the bare wooden floor. They all stood up. They were just in chairs like this. They did the haka. And it was really impressive. They were all in sync. It was all beautifully done. But at the end, they have to rush forward. They all rushed forward, all the chairs fell out. Because they had to sort of take a couple of steps forward. But it was most impressive. We were quite moved. So they made a big thing of that, sort of to try and get a bit of heritage. Because, you know, these older schools have always had lots of heritage from 100 years back and all the rest of it. My mother's still alive, aged 84, and her brother in England's the other one alive. He's 90 whatever, I think he's about 92. He was a submarine commander, and the one that died last year, Terry, he was a destroyer captain, or he was in the service navy. So they had quite a record. So this is the family that my father, who came back, single boy, very spoiled, looked after his mother, who had to come back to New Zealand as well. And he meets my mother, who came from this big family, well, had been a big family, and they got married, and they actually got married at Lindisfarne. So the last thing that was done at Lindisfarne was they had a huge wedding in the grounds. And the lovely thing about Lindisfarne when you go there now is that all the trees that my grandfather planted, they've maintained all the trees. There's some monster trees. I think it's a bit of a worry. There's a huge plane tree in the actual quad area itself on the old front lawn, which is one of the biggest trees you'll ever see anywhere, but it's three-pronged. And they do keep it pruned up the sides, but you know, if one of those limbs fell, I think would cause an awful lot of damage. The trees are magnificent at Lindisfarne, so that's the heritage that the grandfather was able to leave as far as that was concerned. So they got married at Lindisfarne, and then my grandfather then sold Lindisfarne, and they moved up, funnily enough, just across the road here on Duet Road, in a house called Muratile, which is just on the other side of the road from here, virtually. And that's where they lived for many years there when we were growing up. Quite an interesting story, just at Muratile. We always have fox terriers at Clifton, and we used to go and see Grandad a lot at Muratile. He was a very entertaining character. He had the gift of the gab. He was an Irishman, told lots of stories. We never quite knew how much was truth and how much wasn't, but he did tell some fantastic stories, especially about all his hunting days. So we as kids used to love going there. And I had a fox terrier called Snip, who used to always come there, but not a lot. And one time I lost Snip in town. He went off. You know what fox terriers are like, as soon as there's a bitch on heat or something like that, they're gone and you lose them, or a rabbit runs out in front of them. We lost him in town. He jumped out of my car and that was it, lost him. And for 3 weeks we never saw head or tail of him, and we thought he was all gone. And then at the end of about 3 weeks, Grandad from over here at Muratai rang up and said, I think that dog of yours has turned up here. There's a moth-eaten looking fox terrier turned up in the front. And it was this dog, Snip. He'd come back to Muratai here. We'd never know why he went there rather than coming back to Clifton or whatever. Yes. So they got married, and so having gone from this tenuous little thread of my father being born when his mother was 14, they then turned around and had six children, my parents, and three boys and three girls, which was great for Clifton. And those are the days, the heydays, as you all know, in the 50s and 60s. Wonderful time on farms. The farms were very prosperous. It was a great time. Everyone was having big families because they were, I suppose, trying to build up the population after the war, because everyone, you know, had been so depleted. So there were lots of big families. It was a good time to be brought up, especially at someone like Clifton. We were very privileged, as were a lot of people in Hawke's Bay in those days. You know, it was a wonderful life. And we did lots of interesting things. One of the things we did that was a favourite of ours, and I just told the story in the book, because, you know, even though you have these wonderful times, there's always some sort of calamity as well. We've always been a family that always seems to have some sort of little dramas or crises happening all the time. And when we were young kids, we used to go to a place called Flat Rock. You go across what's called Cape Kidnappers Station, now past the golf course, and out to the south side of Cape Kidnappers, and there's the most beautiful private beach down there called Flat Rock, with all these lovely hollow rocks with the sea going through. And then further south you get what's called the Renaika, which is where the old whaling station used to be. Way back in the 1840s there was a whaling station there run by a chap called William Morris. And unbeknownst to us, we knew there was a whaling station always been there, and there's also a wreck there. In my grandfather's time, in about 1885, a ship called the Go-Ahead was actually wrecked there. And you can still see today, the boiler from the ship is actually still on the rocks on the pinnacle of one of the bays, one of what we call the lagoon there. So it's a most magic area. And then you get to the point where you get the Whakapō Bluff, which is what we call the point. If you're at Ocean Beach, when you look north, that's the point you look at. Renaika's really around the north side of the point. And that's where we used to go. But we never appreciated that actually Māori village had always been there as well, a Māori township. And they would have done all the whaling and things as well. There was just a little bit of fresh water there. That's why they'd chosen that spot. There's a little spring comes out of the ground there, and that's why they had it there. Anyway, when we used to go round to the Renaika, we always used to go and spend a lot of time on those beaches and crayfishing and power fishing. There's big sand dunes there, lovely big sand dunes. We were clambering around, and one area on the sand dunes, quite extraordinary, in the middle of the sand dunes is a grove of karaka trees. You don't know how they would grow in the middle of sand. It's just dry sand. But these karaka trees have always been there. Just beside the karaka trees, one of my brothers, Edward, discovered one year a skull, a beautiful skull. It was absolutely intact, the most beautiful teeth. The teeth were all absolutely intact, no fillings. And he thought it was one of the whalers, and he brought it home. We didn't know he had it until we got home, and he produced this skull. And so he had it sitting on his mantelpiece in his bedroom, and he was terribly proud of it. Well, after that, we started as a family, started having all these accidents, which was quite extraordinary. Every member of the family had an accident, some of them quite major. I had an accident where I was, not very long after, I was doing some chainsawing, a chainsaw bounced up and hit me in the face and went right down. I was very lucky not to get killed. And my father jumped off, he was loading cattle one day, and he used to have a signet ring, and he jumped off the side of the and got caught by his ring on the thing. It was just hanging by his little fingers. He ripped his finger. My brother had endless car accidents, and my mother had a dreadful car accident when she and my sister and brother were. My father was quite a flamboyant sort of character. When he got a bit of money when his mother died, first thing he did was went straight out and bought himself an MG sports car, which my mother hated with a passion. It was just a, you know, soft top. But she often had to drive it, and we had a house at Kinloch, and she was driving back, and there was some tar seal. There was always a shingle road there, and then it suddenly hit the tar seal, and my mother got into a skid on the shingle and hit the tar seal, and they just rolled over. And my sister and Charles, my brother, who lives up at the old tomato house up along here, he was young, and he went right under the dashboard, but my sister came right through, and her arm went through the windscreen, and all her arm was ripped off. All the flesh was just taken right off her arm, right down to the bone. So we had this series of accidents. My sister nearly died of an asthma, extreme asthma attack. It just went on and on and on. Then someone came to us, one of the old Maoris that we knew down in the village, and they'd all been observing this, because what happened was, all these things started happening to us, and then everyone talks, they tell stories, and the stories multiplied. So those were the actual accidents, but by the time you heard other people tell them, we were on the end of our tether. It was hardly going to survive the way the stories were going around. And so he heard about all this, and he came to tell us, he said, look, you do realise that that was a Maori village around there. Of course, it would have been a tapu area, so of course, we were in the Land Rover that day with the skull, and we took it straight back out to where we found it, and we deposited back where we'd found it in the dunes and left it there. And at that time, all those little accidents stopped. So we had lots of dramas like that as a family. When you've got a big family, you've always got lots of dramas. But it was a wonderful time to be brought up. And then we all sort of went to schools, and then we went to university, and my father and my mother had never done all that sort of stuff. They weren't academic people at all. So they were quite proud that four of us out of the six all got degrees. And my sister Jenny's now a writer and has written a book on the history of Ponsonby, a big book. Some of you might have seen it, I can't remember what it's called. It's the book on Freeman's Bay, Ponsonby. It's a huge book, and she was also involved with the research on the book. Jennifer Coney, was it? Who wrote the book on women in New Zealand? The New Zealand woman.
Sandra Coney,
that's right, yes. So Jenny has been involved with that. Now she's doing a book with another woman on the history of Remuera, so she's quite an academic. So anyway, we've all sort of gone our separate ways, and eventually I ended up coming back from my travels overseas and blah blah, and came back to Clifton in the 70s, about 77, to help work on the farm, because by that stage my father just felt that he was getting a bit tired of it all, as you do with farming, you know. And so I was very excited, came back, and unfortunately by then farming had slipped right off the edge, and subsidies were still there when I first came back. We had this dreadful thing called SMPs. No, the other subsidy where you got paid every stock unit you owned. And so farmers all around New Zealand, you know, we've got 34 million sheep in New Zealand now, 32 something. At that stage, it reached a peak of 70 million sheep in New Zealand, because you just got paid for every sheep you owned. So people were just pouring on the sheep. I knew one farmer, my brother-in-law's father, who had on 2,000 acres or 2,500, he had 7,000 ewes on his farm because he was just getting money. Of that 7,000 ewes, 2,000 were dry. They didn't produce lambs and they were all small. But that was the sort of a stupid thing that Muldoon brought in to try and encourage farming. They thought it was a numbers game. So when I arrived back in New Zealand, that was just there. And of course, then it all came off. All the SMPs on the wall, all those subsidies came off. So we went into the 80s, and then of course we hit the 80s droughts. So farming suddenly started hitting quite a downward trend. And I sort of took over in about 1981 or something from my father. He sort of retired. We were his partners for a while. So farming, I realised then that farming, somewhere like Clifton, which is a magnificent area to live in, but it's a very difficult farm. It's very dry and lots of gullies and gorges. It dries out very quickly. It's quite difficult. We're quite lucky we've got quite a lot of flats. So I felt that farming was not, you know, we went right through the 80s. We had three major droughts. And we were all very heavily stocked up in those days. The stocking numbers have come down a lot since those days. But we were quite heavily stocked. We used to pour the fertiliser on. But fertiliser is no good if you've got no rain. And so the farm was starting to, you know, go down that way. And I realised that I had to start looking for other ways of, you know, supplementing our income. When you've been on a place as long as we have, there's quite a lot of pressure all the time. You know, because we've been there now for a while, there's quite a lot of pressure to stay there. You don't want to be the ones lost the place. But it doesn't look too good. So it's quite a lot of pressure. And I have always felt this pressure ever since I took over, that I've got to try and keep the place or hand it over to my son as exactly as I received it. But that's getting harder and harder as the time goes on, of course. So luckily for me, one of the things we started doing was cropping. We'd been just pastoral farmers. Wool. Clifton for 130 years had just been a wool farm, and everything had been built on wool. You know, we produced cattle and fat lambs, but they're never fat lambs there. It's all store lambs for people to fatten. But once that great big wool check dropped away, we were always pretty average sort of farm. I mean, we produced good wool, but pretty average as far as that was concerned. So I luckily managed to get involved in growing squash for the Japanese market. A friend of mine came to me and said, would you like to try an experiment to grow early squash? Well, I didn't even know what squash was. It's not a pumpkin, it's like it. It's actually a Japanese hybrid. You see them in the shops, the ones with the green stripes over it. and it's a small one, but it's a much nuttier flavour. And it's actually specifically been engineered by the Japanese. So we buy the seed from the Japanese, and we sell all the crop to the Japanese. But anyway, and I said, well, that's fine, yeah, we'll try it out. Because at that stage, when you did cropping, we've done a lot of cropping for years because we had land at Lawn Road as well. And we used to grow peas, beans, hay, sometimes sweet corn, those type of crops we used to grow. But we always had to grow them for watties, and watties were, if you had a good year, that meant everyone else had a good year. And so they always would bypass you and let you down at the last minute, and it was quite a difficult time growing for watties. So this was an opportunity. They said, well, if you can try and grow this early squash a month earlier. People always grow in Hawke's Bay. In the old days, the saying was, get your crops in before show day. And so everyone used to get their crops in before about the 20th of October. So these guys were saying to me, would you be prepared to take a risk and put a crop in on about the 20th of September, which seemed a bit extreme in those days. So we did it, and it was a success. It worked. The crop, luckily for us that year, I'll explain to you, like this year, has been a ghastly year, but it succeeded. And so we established a niche for this early squash. And then as years went by, I got bigger and bigger, and I was able to command a premium price for my squash because we were the very first boat out of the country. It was all contingent on the boats getting from here to Kobe. The first boats in, you got these amazing prices, quite extraordinary, just for an old pumpkin, you know, the Japanese, they pay extraordinary money. I mean, they go up to, well, many times it's been more than a dollar a kilo, to the grower that is. And one year, it was an extreme year, it went up to $2 a kilo. But on the average, it's around, the early stuff I got, 70 cents a kilo, which is good money, it's $700 a tonne. It was way, way above anything we'd ever done on cropping before, because, you know, we were suddenly make really quite amazing money per acre. Quadruple what we'd ever made out of peas or beans or all these other things. So it was quite dramatic, but it's a very stressful crop to grow as well. My contract was always, I had to be on that very first boat. So then we have all these dramas, like one year, do you remember 1992 when Mount Pinatubo blew up, remember, in the Philippines? Now, do you remember that year, the weather? At this time of year, it was like this every day. We didn't get any sun, and it was just cloudy and drizzly and rain. We got no sun, and the crop just really struggled in it. And we normally harvest straight after the new year, first week of the new year, that's when we harvest. That year we didn't finish harvesting till about the middle of February, so we were miles behind. So we missed the first boats. But luckily for me, we missed the first boat, but everyone else missed the first boat. So we were still the first boat, just a bit later. So luckily we still got reasonably compensated. And then another year we got a hailstorm. I was driving to Auckland on the motorway, our son was at school in Auckland, and I got a phone call from my exporter saying, did you get affected by the hail? And I said, what hail? He said, oh, the hail down at Hawke's Bay. I'm in Auckland. I said, how do you know about the hail? He said, we've just been rung from Japan. The Japanese are amazing. They watch everything. They knew everything that was going on our place just about before we did. And our Japanese buyer had rung our exporter, and he'd heard all about the hailstorm. So I said, well, I'll ring home. I rang my mother and said, oh, we had a hailstorm at home. So how do you know? She says, still hailing right now. How the hell did you know that? So they come all the way from Japan to me and all the anyway, that was a major disaster. We came home and it was just awful. The squash were all just at that crucial tennis ball size and they got pitted. You know, so we've had a lot of dramas over the years with the squash, but in those late 80s into the 90s, it's how we survived, because we wouldn't have survived. And then I also leased a bit more hill country land as well to try and get a bit more size. But it was very difficult times, and that was what got us through. So I was very grateful to squash, even though it was a stressful thing to grow. But I just felt all my eggs were in one basket. By the time we got to the mid-90s, we were completely reliant on the squash. It was carrying the whole farm. So I felt I needed to start looking outside and get away from being dependent on the weather and being dictated to by all these things. And so that's when the idea of doing the cafe came up. We'd already tried different things. We turned one of our cottages into a farm stay, a homestay, and that was all right. But it was quite hard work, and my wife didn't really like it because she was so fussy that, you know, people would stay for one night and she'd insist on having the whole place cleaned and new flowers put in, and it was quite a stressful business. So we didn't do that for very long, but I always had in my mind that we should be doing something with tourism out our way, because, as you know, the gannets, all the tractors leave from the beach in front of us, and I watched for years and years all these cars every Sunday, and it happens in the winter or the summer, cars drive up that way. They drive to the end of the road and they stop, they turn around, and there's a procession of them. And they've been doing it. So I thought, well, you know, it's silly. Here we are, this bear pad. We're right at the end of the road. And so It took a while to work up enough courage to do it. I kept on going to do it, then I wasn't going to do it because it's quite difficult. It's very expensive. It meant taking on a whole lot of debt. We were just creeping out of all the big debt situation we'd been in the 80s when the bank managers had been. In my book, I wrote a story about the bank manager at the time because the banks got really tough on us. A bit like what's happening now. And suddenly we were in there doing budgets and all this sort of stuff that we never had to do before. And this particular bank manager called Rob Carthew, who was the one at the time, actually quite grateful to in a way because he got us more on a business footing and started making us be a bit more business-like about the whole presenting budgets and all this sort of stuff. But he was tough. And he read the book a while ago. I can't remember what I said about it. It was not that bad. And he said, I wasn't that bad, was I? And he was quite tough. So embarrassed when he rang up to say that he'd read the book. It was a sort of a tough time. So we just got out of all that debt because of the squash. And then here was I wanting to go back and plunges. But what I've learned in my business time and whatever is that you can't make money unless you spend money. If you don't spend money, you're not going to make it. So against my wife Dinah's wishes, it was quite a tense time for us because she realised I was going to do it eventually and plunge us back into it. She could not work out why I was going to put us back into debt, and she didn't think it would work. And I did know it was going to work. I'd been watching for long enough to know that the cars were coming out there. The one mistake I made was I was basing it around, I thought it would be the Gannets, the tractor people, that was going to be our main market. In fact, this turned out to be a minuscule part of our market, a very unimportant part of our market. They all parked there, but they've all got their own little luncheons or their whatever, and they've set on going to Gannets. It's a 4-hour trip, so when they get back, they're absolutely exhausted. All they want to do is get in their car and drive home or whatever. So we don't have a lot of business. Sometimes we do if the tide coincides with lunch. So I built the building, which I wanted to build in the style of the old buildings on Clifton. And the woolshed that's in Clifton there now was built in 1886, but there was an old woolshed before that was built in 1861 by my great-great-grandfather, which was a beautiful building. It just looks like the cafe. It was a very steep roof building. It was most impractical, but it was built based on a Scottish shed because they came from Scotland. So it was based on a Scottish shed where you had the shearing in each corner of the thing. It's a dragon sheep. I'm not quite sure where they held the sheep, but it was a very beautiful sheep because it was architecturally designed as well. So I had the old architect's drawings of the building. So I thought when I built the cafe, I'd like to replicate that down there, which is what I did to a certain degree. I did obviously change it a bit, but it was to get that steepness of the roof. And so a lot of people think that building has been there since ever. And I've got a friend who takes a lot of people out there. She's a school teacher and quite opinionated about things. Very good friend, and she said to me, well, I love taking people out to the old whaling station. And I said, what whaling station? And she said, the cafe. And I said, it's not a whaling station. And she said, yes, it is. I said, no, I built that, and you know, it was only built in 99. No, you didn't. She said, I tell everyone that it was the old whaling station. And it's been there since 1840 or something. I said, look, if that's the story you're telling, you just keep on telling it. So, that of course is that we've got the whaling pots out the front. Those whaling pots, by the way, you know, I was talking about the Renaika before and where we had the trouble with the skull. Those whaling pots actually came from there. They were the three tripods that were on the beach in the sand dunes at the Renaika there. And we used to look at them all our lives. They were just there right on the edge of the dunes, and they were sort of, you could only just see a little bit of them. And then they got more exposed, a bit of erosion when the dunes started to erode away, and they started to rust. Starting to get quite rusty, and so my neighbours who owned Summerley Station at the time and my neighbour Bill Shaw decided they would go out and rescue them. So they went out with their bulldozer and the tractors and they rescued them and they brought them home. And Bill Shaw kept two of those down at his place and he did them all up, he painted them and he scraped all the rust down and did a great job. The other one went up to the Nielsen's house and just sat under a tree, and unfortunately when it was exposed to the elements like that, it just completely rotted away. All the water in the bottom was completely rotted away, so that was no good. But luckily, Bill Shaw saved these two. So when I built the cafe, he said, would you like the pots down there? Because it's rather appropriate they should come back. So that's why we ended up with Little thinking that it was the whaling station. But it's been a great success, the cafe. It's a year old. Because when I first built it, I never intended to work myself because I was a farmer. I didn't know anything about restaurants. But I thought, well, I'll build the building. I talked to a lot of people to try and get people interested to come and run it or lease it off me or whatever. No one was interested. They said, oh, it's too seasonal and it's too risky, it's too far out and you'd have to close down all the winter. It's only a summer job. I said, no, it's not. Right. We're going to be open. So eventually, of course, I had to create a business. So we decided to do it ourselves and I employed a chef. First mistake I made was I employed a chef who'd come out of the Air Force. He was an Air Force chef. He'd never known about budgeting. This was the first mistake I made. And of course, whatever he wanted in the Army or the Air Force, they just got. So he came, a lovely chap, and so we set it up with my wife, Diana, very sceptical about the whole business. And pretty cross at me at the time because she felt that I was really risking the whole wall at Clifton, which she thought I was putting us all at risk. But thank goodness, the first year we lost money, and then since then it's been on an upwards run. Although this year, of course, as you can imagine, this last year has been a challenging year. I mean, it's been challenging for everyone, and we're no different from anyone else. But it's a wonderful job. We have about 15 staff there, and we have a manager. Sue, our manager at the cafe, they used to live in my cottage. They were restaurateurs. They ran the Mission restaurant for a while. When the Mission first, this is before it is what it is now, leased the Mission. Then they had their own restaurant in Dalton Street. Anyone remember Casa Gardini in the middle of Napier? It was not a very good spot, but it was upstairs. It was a beautiful restaurant. They're a very good restaurant too. Anyway, they were the ones that kept on encouraging me about this restaurant. Sue kept on saying, are you going to build that cafe out the beach? Oh, yeah, I'd say, but, oh, you know, it's going to cost me an awful lot of money and blah, blah, blah. And I put it on. So they kept on. So when I built it, they'd sold Casa Gardini by then. No, they sold it after we started. But they watched us that first year, and they watched us floundering around. You know, we had these big crowds coming out. We opened the door in the middle of winter. We opened on the 29th, I think it was, of July, thinking that it would be really quiet. We'd open the doors and just get nicely started. And it was a cold, southerly day, snow on the ranges, southerly wind blow. We opened the doors, and this crowd just poured out. And we were completely unprepared for them. And we sort of took a long time to, because everyone had been watching it being built, and they were curious, you see. And we didn't do a good job. The great thing that I've always said to the Hawke's Bay public was they were terribly patient with us, because they kept on coming back, and some people had bad experiences two or three times, but they kept on coming back, and eventually we got it right after more 6 months, I suppose. And we got systems in place, and then Sue and her partner Jo came in and did a bit of consultancy and worked for us for a while and helped us, because I'd set it up as a cafe because I want to keep it really casual. I felt that casual is what everyone seems to like, especially by the beach, you know, because people want to walk down the beach. So it means everyone comes up to the counter and you pay, and then you go away and you're served. But my staff got right on top of me, and I was actually working in the cafe at the time as well, because I felt I needed to learn how to run the thing, as was Diana at times. The staff all eventually prevailed on me to turn it into, you know, a proper restaurant, taking orders and things like that, and it was an absolute disaster. It was an absolute disaster out there, because we're so big. Sometimes we'll have, at any time, 200 to 250 people there at one time, because about 70 or 80 people outside, and sides all full. So it was an absolute disaster. We were losing $500 a week in unpaid bills, because people just, they'd see the big queues there, and they'd, oh, we've had our meal, we'll bugger off. No one was stopping them. The staff were inexperienced. It was really hard to get enough staff to cope with that amount of people. It was an absolute nightmare. I thought, what have I done? This is the worst thing I've ever done in my life. I couldn't believe it. Diana was proven to be right. I thought she'd I couldn't admit to her that we... Then Diana, to her credit, eventually realised, and she came in and got involved as well and helped out. And she managed it for a while. She didn't enjoy that stress and the pressure, because dealing with the public is a terrible experience. I used to work by the bar, and I used to watch them coming in, and every lot of couple came in and looking at the looks on their face to see what type of mood they were going to be in. Dreading it, you know, because we did have some real bad experiences, people really getting angry, and the worst, well, just to tell you some of them, we had a chef at one stage. This chef that I employed from the Air Force only lasted for 2 months, and then he left us in the lurch. It's another thing I didn't know about the restaurant, that they're very fickle chefs. They move around like nobody's business, and they get poached and all this sort of stuff, which is something that I never would have, it was a new world to me. We had him poached by another place. And the second chef took over as the head chef, and he was a burnt out chef. He was a very, very good chef indeed, but he just couldn't cope with the stress of all these people coming in. We did have a big staff, to give him his credit, he was a beautiful chef, but he just had this violent temper, and I'd have to go down and talk to him every day. If I'd missed a day talking to him, that's when he would explode. One day I hadn't been on set, I had to go out mustering early in the morning or something, I hadn't got down to the cafe, and this is the weekend, what happened? He was stressed out anyway, and all these people came in, and he was cooking away, and then suddenly he was getting further and further behind. And as you know, when you're in a restaurant and you have to wait a long time, you get cross and cross, your blood sugar levels go down, and people start getting cross and cross. And this guy got very angry. Of course, we've got an open kitchen, as you know. And he came over and started complaining. Well, I can't remember the chef's name. He completely lost his temper with this guy anyway, and they started exchanging words. And then the guy went back again, just not the way you deal with the public at all. And they waited and waited and waited, and eventually they just lost their temper completely. And they got up and walked out. Well, in the meantime, the chef had thrown down, he'd had other trouble, people coming in all directions. He just threw all his gear down and walked out. And I think we had 150 odd people all hanging around the fence. He said, F this, and he walked upstairs, because we were on upstairs at the top. And he was up there having a smoke and steaming with rage, and then he came out. He obviously felt a bit guilty, so he thought he'd better get back down and do some cooking. And he only had a couple of boys down there who weren't chefs, they were just sort of hands, really, helping. And as he came down the stairs, this guy that he had the trouble with originally walked out with his son, and the guy saw the chef coming down, and they started exchanging. People everywhere, and they started exchanging pleasantries with each other. And so the chef just lost his temper completely, and he came running down the stairs, as did the other guy, and he came running around. They were going to have a full-on confrontation. And luckily, the son was bigger than his father, and he realised what was happening, and he raced in between them and held them apart as they exchanged. And this was at the bottom of those stairs there, with all the people walking back and forth. So it was a nightmare, really. And another time, we had these women complain, there were four women at a table, and I was behind the bar, and someone came and said, Angus, that there's four very angry women in the middle of the restaurant there, and we were absolutely jam-packed. So I went out to see what was wrong. They didn't like the taste of the food. They weren't very happy with something. And so I apologised like crazy. When you do that, you have to apologise a lot, and then you offer them another meal. And so I said, oh, well, look, I'm terribly sorry, but all I can offer you is we'll give you another meal. And they said, ooh, we don't want any more of that food. And they said this in front of all the people. So I slunk off back to the bar and cleaned a few more glasses. So we were very lucky that eventually Sue and Joe came in, took over, professionalised the whole thing, got all our systems going in the booking and all the rest of it. Said to us, for God's sake, give up this being a restaurant table service, go back to being a cafe, be a real casual thing. And that's really the clue to our success, because anyone can come in there. The whole casualness of the whole thing, people feel relaxed, dogs come in, we're not allowed dogs, because the council says we're not allowed dogs. So I put up a sign to modify the council. We've got the sign saying no dogs allowed. People completely ignore it. And they bring their dogs anyway. And, well, that's a part of the whole idea of it. You bring the dog, you can go to the beach or whatever. We always provide water for the dogs. It's part of our casual look, and that's what people seem to like. But Sue's been our manager. She's been there for 8 years on the trot. And I don't think she has any intention of leaving. She said, you've got me for life now, I guess. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman, and just so loyal and positive about everything. When I get all down the dumps about the cost, you know, like today is the 20th of the month. I'm all cheerful now, but I'll go back and then my secretary will hand me the bills for the 20th of the month, and I get all depressed again because we're struggling at the moment. Our margins are getting smaller and smaller. Our costs are going up, all our wages and all our food costs. We don't feel we can put the price of our food up that much because that's part of our attraction. So it's a difficult business, but Sue's been our most amazing manager, and we've got a chef who's been with us for 4 years, so they do stay around sometimes, these chefs. So that's really brought us up to date, although in 2006 we also opened, as you know, at the beginning of the 2000s, or about 2002, was it 2001, Julian Robertson appeared, this American appeared on our doorstep, well not on ours, but on my neighbour's, and flew over, kidnapped it, and liked the look of it so much, he said, I want that. And my neighbour at the time was a chap called Robert Fisher, who's a good friend of ours. He was a real estate man from Wellington. He'd only had the property for 6 years, and he said, well, I don't want to sell it. It's not for sale. But Julian said, oh, aren't they? You know, and he got all his spin doctors out from America. And as it turned out, as you know, he bought Kidnappers for a phenomenal sum of money. It's 5,000 acres, and he bought it for $20 million, which, you know, that just completely changed the whole aspect of our area. And it's affected a lot of things down the line, because that's one of the reasons why we've had all this trouble at Ocean Beach, because it affected the price of Halpery Station, which was undergoing some changes in the family at the time. And they said, well, look, he sold for $20 million. We're now worth much more than what you've valued. So it had an ongoing effect. Anyway, he wanted to build the golf course. It's a very interesting situation we have at Clifton, because the entrance to where you go through the golf course is actually on my land. And it's also where you get through to Clifton. Because it's all these gorges and gullies at Clifton, we have to go through that one entranceway there. So Julian Robertson has an easement through my property to get onto his property. It's an easement, part of the title, but it's all official. But because when my grandfather sold the Kidnappers block, he wanted to sell the Kidnappers block, which was a dry, hard block, and he wanted to keep Clifton, which is what we've got now. But the only access to the Kidnappers was around the beach, which is what we used to always do in the old days, was bring the stock around the beach to the wool shed, or up that gully, up what we call the number one gully, which is where he goes now, and he's got 13 bridges going up there, because we used to just cross the riverbeds. He put a bridge over every crossing. Anyway, it was extraordinary. Our neighbours, Fishers, came to see us and said, you know, what do you think? Well, we said, well, why would we be anti? I mean, we're not one of these people that doesn't like foreign ownership and all the rest of it, because they can't take the thing away. And Julian Robertson, what he's done on Kidnappers is quite a miracle. I mean, he's turned it into an absolute model farm. He's got this wonderful golf course. He's got this wonderful lodge. I know it's a bit exclusive, but he's still turned it into an amazing place. It was a bit of a rundown place that never made money. It was always a very rundown sort of property. But he wanted to put that road through there. I said, well, how are we going to get all our sheep and all our cattle down? Because we had to bring everything down to our woodshed, which is on the beach there, you know, where the big shed is. And we had to bring all our stock down, and he didn't want us bringing stock down. We didn't want to have to bring them down. When you see every day there's service vehicles and cars going up. So he agreed to contribute towards building a new woodshed for us up on the farm, back up about a kilometre and a half inland, up on our holding paddocks. Well, I always wanted to have a woodshed, actually. Never could afford that. It was just amazing. Anyway, we were very, very lucky. So we've always had a very good relationship, he and I. And then he was allowed to put his roads in. He was allowed to bolster up the river. We let him do whatever he wanted to do. And so it's become like a bit of public access. And he's also got those gates at the front, the security gates, so you have to bring in when you're going up there. So we had to compromise quite a lot, but it's worked out really well. So it meant that our old woolshed down on the beach, which is 120 odd years old, was a bit redundant. It's a fantastic shed, it's in fantastic condition. So then I thought, right, we'll do something with the shed, and we'll turn it into a farm show museum and all the rest of it. So there was a guy in Napier called Ian Richardson who'd already started doing this in a wool store testing station in Napier, a terrible place. He'd done a wonderful job inside this shed, and he created this whole world inside this ghastly old shed. But he was in the back of Ahuriri, where no one even knew where he was. And he wasn't allowed to have sheep there or anything. He had to bring them in by the day. He was paying, I couldn't believe it, he was paying $800 a week in rental. I don't know how they could have done that to him. He was only getting sort of three or four people through. He was going downhill very fast, and I ran into him and said, well, look, there's not room for two of us in Hawke's Bay. You come out to Clifton, because we're much better set up for tourists out there, because of kidnappers and blah, blah, blah. I will set up the woolshed, and we built a shop using all old materials. He had an old woolshed that he dismantled, and so we used all the old materials and got into trouble with the council, of course, because we put it up. And I thought, well, seeing as down at the camp there, they're allowed to have their caravans with their awnings on skids, we should be able to put this building on skids. So we put it on skids. And then I had to go for an application to put in toilets for the tourists, and the building inspector said, hang on, that building's not meant to be there, that's not meant to be on skids. And so panic stations, and we were in a bit of trouble. The building inspectors came out. Luckily, I know Lawrence Yule quite well, so I rang Lawrence and said to Lawrence, look, I'm in a bit of trouble here, Lawrence. Do you mind if I use your name and tell them that? Because I know what they're going to be like. They're going to come out, they're going to be heavy-handed, and they're going to tell me to take it all down, which is what they did. One thing, they just came in, oh, this is hopeless, you're going to take it all down. I said, oh, I knew you'd say that. That's why I rang Lawrence, you were about... And they looked at me, why did you ring him? Why did you have to ring him? I said, because I knew you were going to be heavy-handed like this. You know, we've done everything well, we've built the whole thing, and you're being... Well, no, we can work it out, we can work it out. So we were able to come to a compromise. It cost me a lot of money. I had to jack the whole building up, and we then had to put piles and underneath, but it worked out. So we have a shop there, a wool shop, and then we have the wool shed, and we set up a stage, an auditorium area, and we can put 100 people in at a time in the auditorium. And then before we'd even started, we were approached by Nimmons and these operators from Auckland who said, would you be prepared to do cruise ships? And we said, yes, of course. I mean, this is manna from heaven. And so the cruise ship is our basic industry thing there now, what we do with the wool shed. They come in, we do a dog show, and we've got pigs, and we've got old pet sheep. They go through, we've got the museum, the whole wool shed's a museum, and then we do a farm show for them, and then they go to the shop, and then they go across to the cafe, they finish off at the cafe. So it's working out really well. But unfortunately, the cruise ship industry itself is actually on a bit of a downer at the moment. It's, you know, not a lot of people going, and there's too many Australians. What happens is that... I'm not being anti-Australian, but I'm just saying the Australians are not interested. They're just not interested. They just don't want to know about it. So, fortunately, when we get the Americans and the Canadians, it's fantastic because they love all this stuff and they're so enthusiastic and they just love it. But the Aussies don't come, so that a lot of these cruise ships now are filling up with Aussies, so the numbers have dropped a bit. But it's still working out well. And then just the last thing, I'll just catch up quickly, because you mostly read about it, the beach, the camp got washed out, the road got washed out in the winter. We were away overseas at the time. And the road, as you know, along there, that very ugly road with all that concrete, got washed out, and Lawrence Yule had been badgering me for a long time about giving them more land. And we said, we don't want to give any more land because we've done this for centuries. My grandfather gave the camp to them, and we've given them the road twice. But anyway, the road washed out. Poor old camp was completely stuck. The council were about to renew the lease. They said, no, we won't renew the lease unless you can secure your access. So I was approached, of course, and I said, all right, we came to an agreement where I lease them land now. We bought the fence right back. I brought it back far enough that I know, because it's going to erode quite a lot there, and they put a new road in, and I leased them the land, and then the two councils plus the camp have paid to have all that concrete removed. So it's been a huge amount. There's over 5,000 cubic metres of concrete dumped there over the years, because it's been a dumping ground there since the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So I said to the council, we've got lots of these gorges and these big holes up on the farm. you come up there. So they did all their resource management stuff, and we found an area that was absolutely ideal for what they wanted. Saved them a huge amount of money, because otherwise they're going to have to cart it from Clifton all the way to behind Napier somewhere, and it would have cost them an absolute fortune. So saved the council, I'd say $100,000 or more by doing that. So they were able to do that, and they've done it all. It's all gone. And so the beach has just been, it's still very unstable, of course, you can imagine. So what's going to happen now is the sea just has to find its own level. It'll come in and it'll take away a lot of land, and it'll roll away, and then it'll form a, eventually, we're hoping, it'll form a crest, and then once the sea can form its own bay back again, it'll be right. The bay was sort of, you had the bay, that concrete cut across the bay, it stopped the sea, and the sea doesn't like it when it's resisted like that, and it starts to roll. So what the sea did, it just kept on going down, 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 until it got underneath, and then it just ripped everything out. So that's the current state of affairs with the beach now. So the camps renewed their lease, and we leased them the land for the access. So there we are.
Great story. Thank you so much for coming again today. I think you've rounded the story off for us today, because you're one of my heroes, because the Gordon family and the number of generations that have been on the property, and you displaying the same genius for finding opportunities where before there looked to be no opportunities, I think that's an inspiration. And we wish you well into the future. And yeah, the cafe's a very good one. I've always enjoyed it.
I like to hear that. That's what I always like to hear. Well, yeah, you know, this drama's this year, for example, I haven't grown squash for 8 years because I've actually been leasing out the pastoral, the hill country, for a while, and I'm just farming the flats. And this year we decided to grow squash because the cropping's really hard at the moment. There's no market for wheat, barley, maize, and I've grown squash again. We planted early, really early this year, on the 7th of September, and it came up beautifully in 2 weeks. It was all looking fantastic, and then we got that snowstorm on the 9th, and that lasted for a whole week, and I lost about 15 acres. So it's never not stressful. There's always some new drama or new challenge every year.
May I be allowed to add my voice to this assembly? I'm sure every one of you, like myself, has been utterly absorbed by this brief history in a short segment of time. Two historians are famous in the annals of history making. One of them is Herodotus, the other Thucydides. I think to that duo we can add a third. The Gorn. The Gorn. Yeah, it's been absolutely marvellous. And I don't think I shall ever be able to thank him enough. But that being said, in the course of his exposition, he mentioned certain traits of the Irish that you have to take with a bag of salt. I leave you to draw your own conclusions. But Peggy, who is really with a companion of hers, and you, who I refer to always as the Valkyrie, is largely responsible, in fact probably entirely responsible, for Duart being here, for us being here, for you being here. And she has asked me, on behalf of the Duart Committee,
thank you very much, that's very kind. I didn't need to do that at all. Thank you, Peggy.
I, for one, could listen to you every week.